All right, so just a bit of housekeeping first. There was some confusion over the hashtag. Originally, the South By folks wanted to put SX in front of everything, so we called it SX Cooking. Then they took that away, so some people thought it's cooking, some people thought it's SX Cooking. We'd like you to stick with SX Cooking, just because the cooking hashtag has way too much noise on it. We won't be able to sort of listen to your feedback or figure anything out. Or you can also tweet to either me or Mike directly at Studio Feast or at Webahead. So, welcome to my robotic kitchen plan this dinner party. So what are we going to talk about in the next hour, just to kind of give you all a sense? We're going to take you through a product design story about cooking. Mike and I both love to cook, that's how we met, and we think that life is better when friends cook and eat together. But a lot of people don't cook for whatever reason, various reasons, so we spent the last few months researching and building different ways of how technology can improve the cooking experience. We researched automated cooking robots, we built an intelligent kitchen scale, and we created some software to sort of model how a chef might think about cooking. We use those tools to cook for friends, we ask our friends to use that to cook for their friends. And so today we're just going to share that work with you, what we've learned, and hopefully we can have a larger conversation about how we can improve that moving forward. Sound good? Great? Excited? Pumped? Let me hear it. Come on. All right. So, who on earth are we?
Yeah, so we'll start with me. I'm Mike Lee. I lead a dual life a little bit. By day, I do strategy at an agency called Bond Strategy in New York. By night, I founded a supper club group called Studio Feast. We create dinners in places where they normally shouldn't happen, and we've been doing that for about 5 years now. Some of the stuff we've done, you may have heard of this L-Train thing we did last year. We did a six-course lunch on the L-Train in New York City. We had 46 people involved, and every four or five stops along the L-Train from 8th Avenue to the last stop had a new course on it. So it was 12 people on the train, and they ate on the train, and it was pretty weird. We also did a dinner called the Doppelganger Dinner, where we had seven courses. Half of it was omnivore, half of it was vegetarian. Although we one side was omnivore, one side was vegetarian, but they visually looked identical using completely different ingredients. So, can you guys guess which one is the vegetarian version of this? The right. That's the omnivore version. The one on the left is potatoes that we carved and we filled with onion marmalade, and the right is a bone marrow thing. So that's another really weird thing that we did. But we also just do really simple dinners, and honestly, you know, sometimes we'll do strange concepts. But we all just kind of understand the power of food to bring someone together. And the concept is kind of like the cherry on top. So that's what we do. We cook and we get people to get together.
And so I'm Will Turnage. By day, I'm the VP of Technology and Invention at RGA, where I work with a bunch of very amazingly talented folks to create digital products and experiences for a lot of our global clients. If you're an amazingly talented folk and you would like to work for us, come see me afterwards. But after hours, I've also found ways to combine my love of technology with my love of cooking. Most significantly, in the past few years, I've released two apps as a partnership with the food writer Michael Ruhlman. The first is Ratio, which is based on his book, and the second is Bread Baking Basics, which is all sort of about baking, and that's available for iPad, Kindle Fire, and Barnes & Noble Nook. But it's not just about tech, it's about people too. I've been hosting dinner parties, both large and small, in my home for the last 15 plus years. And when friends and food kind of come together, you know, that's when the magic happens.
So we, let's get to the heart of it. We truly think the dinner party is a magical format. I look at my life and I've grown up around food. I grew up in a food family where life was just the stuff you did in between meals. And then even then, it was just more stuff to feed the next meal that was coming. My mom even finished the basement of the house just so we could have more people over. And the more people we had over, the more she would want to cook. Because I think she has food ADD. She can't just eat one thing. So it would be like 16 things for, you know, 25 people. And that was just a regular way of life. I think the dinner party is magical because it slows people down and it brings everyone to a point of focus where, you know, it's still kind of socially unacceptable to be on your phone and be pecking away at something else and just focus on, you know, food and your friends. I think it's a really simple combination we overlook a lot. But if you think about all of the great meals you've had in your life, how many of them did you have them by yourself? And if you think about all the great moments you've had with someone in your life, the conversations, how many of those involve food? Probably most of them. So if you believe that this dinner party can be magical, it kind of changes the way you look at food and changes the way you look at cooking. Where someone could see a set of groceries sitting on a counter, they see that as just food or sustenance. I see that as kind of like the raw materials to create these great memories with your friends. So if you believe that, you would think, well, that's a good thing. People want to do this more often. People should be throwing dinner parties and making these things happen more often. But we know that's not the case. Why don't people throw more dinner parties? And we started to talk to some people and ask them why. And I think, you know, it kind of broke down into a few reasons. One is probably the most obvious. I don't know how to cook. I don't know how to cook. I mean, I don't have the experience. I haven't done it before. That's probably the most straightforward one. That's probably the one that most people claim. There's a lot of solutions out there that can chip away at this problem of learning how to cook, but we feel they don't really solve the real problems of the experience and don't look at it holistically. So maybe you can cook, but you can't cook for other people. So you're good enough to just do something for yourself, but you're not maybe ambitious enough or confident enough to put yourself out there and have somebody put something that you made into their body. That's quite a undertaking, so I can understand that. So I can cook for myself, but maybe not for other people. Okay, so maybe you can do that, maybe you can cook for other people, but it's just too much for you. There's so many moving parts for you to think about. Cooking efficiently for a lot of people takes a lot of work and organization, and I think this is not something that comes innately, and I think it's not something that the food media and things like that out there really teach too well. Okay, so maybe you can do all of these things, but it's just not worth the trouble. Maybe the last time you did it, a whole pile of dishes piled up, and it was just too much effort. You couldn't do it efficiently. That's something very understandable, and that's a problem too. So these links, like, there's missing links here, and it all boils down to three things. You know, knowledge, lack of knowledge, lack of organization, lack of effort. So that's kind of how Will and I approach this problem. There's a user experience problem, I think, of trying to cook a dinner party and organize a kitchen and produce food. And these are the things that I think are the problems, and it's something that technology, I think, can solve.
So I said, let's build a robotic kitchen. I got this great big idea, like, all right, let's look at this and let's figure out, you know, how can we sort of use technology and robots and stuff to make this easier for you. But like all sort of product thinking, you know, okay, let's research, let's see what's going on out there, let's see what other people are doing in this space. So the robot on the left is the Arm 3 being built by a university out in Germany, and on the right is the Chief Cook robot, which is part of a university program in France, actually. And they're both learning robots. So there's a lot of research into, you know, they sort of watch you cook or you sort of guide them through the cooking process, and then they learn that and they can repeat it and do it over and over. The robot on the left is, it's been in development for 4 years. It can take things out of the dishwasher and put them away, and it can make about 5 or 6 recipes. The Chief Cook robot can make a ham and cheese omelet, which is everything you see there, but you still have to crack the eggs for it. Its arms don't really allow for cracking. This next robot is a robotic hand that picks up sushi off of the serving platter and moves it to your plate. Now you laugh, but there's actually an amazing amount of research that goes into this when you think about that, because you have to have the sensor to know where the sushi is, you have to be able to have the right amount of grip on it, just enough so that you can pick it up without crushing the rice, without squeezing it and having it fall apart. I mean, like, you laugh, but it's very hard, and then you pick it and you move it and you have to sort of set it down gently and rest it so you don't drop it and have it roll over. Really, really amazing, important research that's going on, but I don't know if there's room or need for this in my kitchen. Some Chinese students in Shanghai realized that a lot of Chinese cooking is made by taking a bunch of ingredients and putting them in a wok. So they built this gigantic automated wok that will do that for you. It makes over 600 recipes, but it's enormous, and it's controlled by this touchscreen. And so we just started looking at all these things and thought, okay, these things are big. Like, I don't have room in my kitchen for this. I don't even know how much they cost, but I can't imagine they're cheap. So are there smaller things out there? And so in Japan, we found some design students who made these smaller robots. And basically, you build this platform on top of your pot, and you set all the ingredients on and whisks and things in the robot arms. And they sort of self, you know, communicate with each other, and will drive in and dump the ingredients. And, you know, it makes one thing. But it's still a lot of work. So at this point in our examination of this, we're starting to kind of get down. You know, it's like we wanted to build this great robotic kitchen, but you're realizing how hard it is. But the biggest problem that we were having with these robots and these things is we went back to our users' pain points. You know, knowledge, organization, effort. And this maybe solved some of the effort problem, but not even all of it. It doesn't, you know, these things aren't smart. You know, they can't help you figure out what to cook for dinner. They can't, you know, look at a bunch of ingredients and say, oh, here's what you should do, here's what you should make. A lot of the problems that we face every day, you know, these are just sort of, factory workers. And they're also really expensive. I can't imagine, you know, how much these cost, but I probably can't afford them. So we said, all right, if we're going to do this, we should start small. We should try to, what's a small thing that we can do? And so we started with a kitchen scale. So why a kitchen scale? So first, they're cheap. This kitchen scale I bought off Amazon for $20. Really, really cheap. The second reason is that a lot of people don't realize that when you cook by weight and you measure ingredients by weight, you can actually have much more accurate cooking results than if you cook by volume, especially when it comes to baking. So a lot of times if you take, you know, one cup of flour, that can have anywhere between 4.5 or 5.5 ounces of flour, and a lot of times that explains why something doesn't work when you make it the second time or when you make it the third time. But when you cook with weight, you're using the exact same consistent amount of every ingredient every time, and so you get more consistent results. So we said, all right, let's start with a kitchen scale. What's something simple that we can do? We said, all right, well, let's teach people to make bread. So I took this kitchen scale and I hooked it up to this tablet computer. I'm not going to do a live demo, but if you guys want to come up afterwards and see it, I'll show it to you. And basically, you know, a loaf of bread is just 20 ounces flour and 12 ounces water. But when you use a normal kitchen scale, you're kind of looking at the numbers, remembering where you were, doing some math, and going back and forth. And so what this tries to do is it tries to represent all that visually. So, you know, I'm adding flour to the bowl, and you're seeing this sort of visualization of flour moving up, and there's this bar chart in the middle. And so the idea is just, you know, keep adding flour until it gets to the end, and then you know you're done. And you can just, and then when you finish this, it will switch over, and we're almost there, just a little more flour. So when you get here, it'll flip over, and then it'll say, okay, hey, add water. And yeah, so there we go. So now you just add water, and then when it reaches the end, it says stop. Now, but we sort of took it one step further. So, like, this is kind of cool, but, you know, if I was making this at home and I was pouring the water in and just started talking to Mike or whatever, like, what happens if I put in too much water? What do I do now? Well, this thing will recognize that, oh, you put in too much water, it'll auto-recalculate the recipe on the fly, and then kick you back to the flour screen and say, you know what, you went a little overboard with the water, so just add this tiny much flour to sort of even it out and work it out. So, you know, we took this demo and we started showing it to people. Here's some sort of closer examples of what the screens look like. So the video didn't do the graphics justice. And we started showing this to people and talking to them about it. And they liked it, but they were like, yeah, that's a pretty cool idea. But what they loved about it wasn't the basic concept. It was the fact that if they screwed up the recipe, that the thing would fix it for them. It would tell them how to fix it. They basically wanted a cooking expert in the kitchen with them to help them through the process, you know, going back to the knowledge side. And this was sort of our first big aha moment in the process. At this point in time, we've sort of been thinking about, you know, robotic kitchens and robots and tools, that all these things that would do the work for us, but our users kept coming back with the exact same pain points, knowledge, organization, effort. And that's when we sort of realized that gadgets are solving the wrong problem. You know, gadgets are you know, they're meant to do sort of these menial tasks quickly and effectively, but they're not intelligent. They're not really helping us through the holistic cooking experience, which is what all of us have to face every day. And sort of one way that we thought about it, you know, was, you know, do I want a line cook or do I want a chef? You know, so in a restaurant, you know, what line cooks do is they execute, and they execute really well. You know, they chop the onions, they get everything out, the orders come in, they ship them out, and they are machines at doing this. The chef, on the other hand, does all the planning, all the menu planning, the strategy, the timing, determines what can be made in advance, what has to be made at the last minute, and then also deals with all of the different on-the-fly adjustments that happen over the course of a night, when you get a really picky eater that comes in or someone else. So today, we had kind of focused on, you know, these robots, these line cook robots, but now we realize our users aren't asking for this. What they're asking for is a robotic brain, is a mind that will help them do this. And so we said, okay, all right, let's build a robotic brain. You know, how do we do that? Well, first, how does the mind of a chef work? And I asked that to Mike.
So I'm not a professional chef, and I'll be the first person to tell you that. I raise the flag definitely for the home cook. And, you know, I've almost had to learn from professional chefs and take what they do day in, day out, even more to heart, because we make these dinners happen in places where they don't happen, and you have to be that much more organized and that much more together to do it. So, you know, part of us doing these weird dinners is not to say everyone else should do really weird conceptual dinners. It's also to say, if a guy like me with a day job can do something like this, as strange as this, the average person should be able to just roast a chicken for their family on a Sunday night. It doesn't mean you have to work a lot harder or have education. You just have to think a little bit like a chef and take some of the lessons they learn. So what do chefs do innately, right? They cook for the situation, right? So they know what kind of guests are coming in. They know, you know, what kind of style they want, what kind of scale they want. Do they want a, you know, crazy tasting menu, or do they want like a simple kind of meal? They know how to adapt to dietary restrictions. That all comes from, you know, just intelligence of knowing how to improvise with the situation, and you can't really epicurious.com your way out of that necessarily. Adapting to available ingredients is also a really big thing. You know, chefs do this they cook with the seasons a lot, and everybody should too, but sometimes you just have stuff lying around the house and you don't know what to do with it. Chefs can have a base level of knowledge to take recipe formats and adapt them to whatever you have at hand. They don't panic if you have a tomato sauce recipe and one thing of basil is missing. They just kind of roll with the punches. Combining steps, this is probably the biggest aha we had. Anyone can Google a bunch of recipes and call it a dinner party, but do you really know how to cook a dinner party? These recipes that are out there exist in silos, and they exist as single dish things. They focus on the end result. So if I go to a website and find five recipes, I can get all these great steps and ingredients to do these five dishes, but I can't combine them into one single workflow. And time again, when we talk to people who cook at home, that's the one big sticking point. I don't know how to time this all. I don't know how to make these five sheets of paper go into one single workflow. Cooks do this. Cooks know the master prep list based on their menu. They can organize things that have to be done ahead of time versus a la minute right at the second of serving and adjust accordingly. Being efficient with ingredients. You know, the end of every meal is the start of another good meal, so you know, every chef kind of innately knows how to do that. Home cooks don't always know how to do that. And then prep wisely. That goes in part to the combining of the steps, but just knowing what hard work can be done ahead of time and then, you know, what can be ready for you at the moment is one skill that chefs do. So if you try to do this, we wanted to digitize all of those things. How do you digitize that innate intelligence? It's really, really hard. But the first step, we started with a menu, and it was really clear from the start that any recipe formats that we have out there in existence, they don't really work to kind of do this. They really excel just for cooking that one dish. So we had to create this modular menu, and it became pretty clear that we needed so much extra data on each step and each ingredient, and that was really our start. So I'll zoom into this in a second, but this is the spreadsheet we started for beef tataki, seared beef. It's fairly simple. You get nice beef and you sear it for a sum total of 90 seconds, and there's a sauce that goes with it. The first thing we started was the ingredients. We wanted to be able to have those scalable. So you have all the ingredients here. There's quantities in grams. Again, back to the scaling thing. And everything's in grams, and then it scales just quite simply based on the number of guests that you have. We ran into some challenges, though, right? Because, say you're baking a cake, right? You're not going to bake a cake for just one person. Like, no one's going to take a cake recipe for a 9-inch baking pan and scale that down to one thing, right? So there's some things that are challenging because they don't scale exactly linearly. Fortunately, this one did pretty well. The next thing here is like taking the method, right? So a recipe that you all know will just quite simply list out all of the steps. We've done that here, but everything needs so much more data in order to make it modular. You need to know how far in advance could you do it? What's the range, right? Is it advisable to make a salad dressing 3 days before? Probably not. You want that a little fresher. But you know, you also don't have to make it 1 minute before you have to serve it. So everything like has a range of how far in advance it can be prepared. Dependencies, right? You can't frost a cake until you've baked the cake, right? That's a really simple, obvious answer. But if you start thinking about a recipe and five recipes coming together, there's a lot of different dependencies you have to think about. Time per ingredient is also another big thing. So chopping one onion takes you maybe a minute. Chopping 10 onions, is that 10 minutes? Or do you get economies of scale from your workflow and it takes you, 8 minutes? That's another thing we had to work on too, is how do you scale that? So this starts to add on, into a really big kind of data problem of how do you design recipes to do this. So we kind of worked on a solution. We built something. I wrote a menu with all that data in there. Will coded it up into an app. And we threw a dinner party. And we threw the dinner party and ran it all on this software just to see what would happen. We made the beef tataki, Japanese clam soup, a beet salad with endive and blood orange, yum. Braised pork belly with risotto and roasted fennel. It's the biggest shit-eating grin faces we could possibly make. Just let that soak in for a second. And then, apple cake with ginger ice cream and miso butterscotch, just like mom used to make. So we ate, we drank a lot, and we generally had a great time, and it was a really good experience. So that's where our dinner party ended. But the true test of this was, could this start new dinner parties?
So how do we share this with others? I mean, obviously, you've seen the spreadsheet, and you've started to sort of get your head wrapped around the problem we're dealing with. But you can't really just hand that spreadsheet off to someone and say, hey, go do this. So we had to think about how to sort of distill all the knowledge of that's in there and sort of turn it into something more user-friendly but still had all that capabilities inside it. So after our dinner party, we took everything and we sort of shrunk it down, and all of our guests, we gave them access to this app and asked them to take that app, use it, and cook dinner for their friends. So the app is extremely simple. It's basically two web pages. This is done in a responsive web design, so it'll work on a desktop computer, on a tablet, or if you look at it on your iPhone, it'll realign and look nice on the phone. But basically, at this first stop, I'm going to use the pointer. So here, you are allowed to sort of select which dishes you wanted to make, and you could just click on one, two, or three. You can only make one. You could make two or any combination. And it would automatically update the shopping list. I mean, that's kind of a common known thing. We allowed you to select the number of guests, and then we allowed you to set what time dinner should be served. That's all sort of, I think, kind of existing sites do that a lot. And then here at the bottom, we basically said, we looked at dietary restrictions. We said, select any foods your guests can't eat, and we'll update everything automatically. So say you had someone coming to dinner, and they don't eat beef, and they don't eat pork. Well, you just click on beef and pork, and now suddenly the beef tataki is a tuna tataki, and the Japanese clam soup with bacon is now a Japanese clam soup with mushrooms. The ingredients list change, and this sort of supports all different dietary restrictions. So if you have gluten allergies, then we'll replace the soy sauce with tamari. And we sort of took this all here. So users would use this to plan the menu. Then once they were done, they would click on the other tab, and they would see a timeline and a list of steps. We sort of had, I'm a really bad designer, so this is about as good as I can do. We color-coded the different recipes, and then we sort of broke it out by steps. So you can see, okay, here's what you can do 2 days before, here's what you could do a day before, and sort of the day of, we would start to block out the steps. So when you create the timeline like this, there's a lot of benefits to this that aren't necessarily apparent. I mean, first, it's dynamic, so if you want to make one recipe, it'll just auto-adjust, and it's always based on when you want dinner to be ready. Also, because this isn't a digital format, there's a lot of interesting things that we can do that you can't do in a print format. Just as simply as, you know, when you're writing out ingredients in a step, you know, now we can update that with the exact amount. You know, so rather than saying, oh, put the flour in the bowl, you know, we can say, put 15 ounces flour in the bowl. And we can save the users the time and effort of having to go back to look at the ingredients to figure out how much, and back and forth. And it's sort of all because it's digital. The other thing we can do is we can adjust this timeline to your preferences. So if you're someone who wants to make as much as you can ahead of time, so that you can, you know, spend as little time when your guests are there actually cooking, great. Click that option, it'll slide all the steps sort of a day or two in advance and work you through it. Or if you're just spontaneous and you say, hey, I want to make something, it can push it all to the front of the line and say, all right, here's what you got to do to get it done. The last thing that it also does is, by making a timeline, it allows us to focus on the non-food part of having people over. So, you know, we can say, oh, you just put the bread in the oven, you've got 30 minutes downtime. Why don't you set the table? Why don't you play some music? Open some wine. Have a good time. You know, there's a lot of that aspect of having people over for dinner and cooking that recipes don't ever talk about and recipes don't ever share. And this allows us to sort of put all that into one flow. So this is what we shared with people, and you know, it's not perfect. It's a good first step, and we think it's pretty cool, but ultimately, it really doesn't matter what we think about it. It matters what other people think about it. Do they find it useful? Do they find it, you know, something that will help them?
So this is Laura. Laura is a good friend of ours, and she came to our dinner party. And one of the catches of getting a free meal was that she had to recreate a part of this meal on her own with her own friends. So that's what she did. Right away, she, you know, overall it went great for her, and she was able to pull it off pretty easily. She didn't go as balls out as we did with a 5-course crazy meal, but she, you know, had two friends over. It was a Tuesday, and she just wanted like two courses. So she did a beet salad and the beef tataki. First of all, it was really great for her to easily just scale that down. We had 8 people at our dinner party. She easily could scale everything down without having to do a bunch of math. And everything was portioned to what 3 people would need to eat. She could also do a lot of prep on her own, and she knew what she could do by herself before her guests came over. And then, you know, her guests were pretty good friends, so they could kind of team up with her. She could delegate that to them as well. So here's them, you know, here's the delegating shot. But she found that she could delegate really simply too, because of the way that the steps work. And because it's all, you know, accessible through an iPhone, instead of, you know, trying to scribble off a part of a recipe from a sheet, tearing out steps 4 through 6, you can just have them have it up on their phone, and it's in their hand, and they can see it on their own. So it's kind of like you can distribute marching orders pretty easily. And the instructions are written in a way that's very, very literal. Sometimes it's harder for people who aren't experienced cooks to delegate, because you find you have to explain so much more, and it's just, you know, it's one of those things where you're like, okay, forget it, I'll just do it myself. But this makes it really easy to split off tasks logically and have people work on it with her. She picked up a little bit on our food porn habit, so she got this shot. Very nice, Laura. But, you know, she did the beef thing, and, you know, she's gluten-free, so she swapped out soy sauce with tamari. That's a pretty simple example, but, you know, if you're a gluten-free person, like, you probably will appreciate that kind of thing happening, where we pull out all these things that you can't possibly eat. She made some adaptations to it, but, you know, overall she had a good time, and it was a really nice girls' night, I guess. So, the big thing for us was that this technology isn't necessarily just making cooking better. I think because of this, if we can lower the barriers to making a dinner, we can create a dinner party where a dinner party never existed before. And that's creating the conversation that never existed before, that's creating jokes that never existed before, creating something you can refer back to that never existed before. And if we can do that with technology and software, that's a pretty big win for us.
So what did we learn from all of this, from doing this? We've been spent the last few months working on this, and was it perfect? No. But was it fun? Yeah. Did we eat well? Yeah. It was great. I think the first big lesson that we really focused on that just came up more and more, and this is just known as simplify. How do we make it simpler? And this is across a lot of different levels. Even just from the recipe standpoint, you know, I think we really aimed high with our first set of recipes, and that's probably too high for a lot of users or novice cooks, you know. So I think we're going to sort of look at how do we make some even more simple recipes or smaller courses. Also, just from the interface of everything, you know, the version that you saw of the app looks pretty simple, but I should have shown you the earlier version where I had at least 4 or 5 additional panels with options and checkboxes and sliders and ways that you could sort of customize it to your own liking, but it just took away from the experience, and it was too much and it was too confusing, and we're trying to make this easier. And finally, also thinking about devices as well, you know, Mike talked about the iPhone. When we hosted the dinner party, we had iPads all set up in the kitchen so we could look at it. And it was amazing to me because everyone's walking around the kitchen with their iPhones in their hand, and they're just dancing and taking pictures and doing whatever. And then whenever it came to the point of, oh, what's next, everybody like stopped and squinted over the iPad, and I was amazed at the dramatic difference of how people moved so fluidly with one device and had to sort of stop and break the momentum for the other. So, you know, for us, I think that the challenge is how do we take this experience and simplify it, you know, so that it works just as well on this tiny, tiny screen that you can just walk around the kitchen with.
Yeah, and I think that's really important because I think for the normal average human being, trying to throw a dinner party is, you know, is a total shit show. It can be, it's never as easy as you think. Something is always not exactly right, and you're basically juggling all these things. Someone's, you know, yapping in your ear, so I think it can't be simple enough, especially in this situation. Another thing we learned was that culinary pattern recognition is really key. If you think about how recipes are written right now, it's akin to just teaching people straight up multiplication tables. It's very, very rote learning based on memorization. So if you don't really take an extra step and understand how a braised something is made, you can only make that, right? But, you know, braising a pork shoulder and, you know, braising something else like that, like a brisket or something like that, is essentially the same technique. But if you just memorize a recipe, if you can't find pork shoulder, you're just, you know, you're out of luck, right? You don't know that you can adapt these things. So I think part of the theory of how we're approaching this is don't focus on rote recipes. Focus on these patterns of cooking, basic techniques, basic flavor combinations. And you know, we had beef tataki here as an example. But I would argue it's not about learning how to make this esoteric Japanese beef thing. It's about learning how to sear. And if I told you how to make beef tataki and I can teach you, give you a piece of tuna, do the same damn thing and you can make seared tuna. I give you a piece of salmon, you can do the exact same thing. So that's the kind of pattern recognition that we think about cooking with. And I think that, if you can teach people that or digitize that, it opens up a whole world of possibilities in the amount of things you can cook.
We touched on this earlier, but I think also, you know, you don't need the gadget, you need the brain. I think there's a lot of focus now on, you know, the TV commercials, oh, slap chop, dun-dun-dun-dun-dun, makes life easier, you know? And it's like, yeah, great, it really does chop that onion a lot faster, but it doesn't help me, you know, figure out what to make for dinner. If I have a freezer full of CSA food, you know, what am I going to do with that? I don't know. The slap chop can't help me with that. And, you know, we constantly came back to our users' pain points, you know, knowledge, organization, and effort, and how can we sort of address those problems?
The last thing that you know we learned was structure breeds freedom. And if you go back to the anecdote I shared at the beginning about why we think dinner parties are magical and why we love them, I said, because it slows down the world so you can focus on the food and you can focus on your friends. But for some people who, you know, throwing a dinner party is a really hard thing, you can't actually, the world doesn't slow down for you, it accelerates, and accelerates really badly. So you can't focus on that, and it's a negative experience. With this structure, we hope that, you know, you can take some of that brain power you were devoting to trying to balance everything, let the technology do the job, and then take that brain power and focus it back where it counts, is on your friends and on the food. Because at the end of the day, you want to do this just to have a great social experience. The dinner party is the original kind of in real life experience. And yeah, so I think structure breeds freedom to get you there. So we've got a lot to go, and you know, we're going to keep playing on this and plugging away. But I think the one thing's certain, we're going to have a lot of good meals coming up.
And so that's it. But you know, we're still thinking about this. We have a lot to improve upon and work upon, but we kind of wanted to leave the rest of the time if people want to ask questions or have conversations about this. I'm curious to hear your thoughts of what you think, what you like, what works, what doesn't. One bit of housekeeping, the South By people asked us to remind everyone to go into the South By app and rate the panel. That's how they're judging a lot of these things. So if you launch the app and tell us what you think, give us feedback, feel free to tweet us. So, first up?
Yep. Hey, awesome work, guys. So when's the app going to be available?
That's the first question we always get. I mean, honestly, I don't know. It's to me, this is like, it's like a product feature. I think it's sort of, the hardest part of the whole thing is writing the recipes, you know? And it's more metadata and more information than you think. Part of the reason why we even focused on dinner parties was it was more of a creative solution to get around the whole problem of recipes. You know, if I launched a website with 50 recipes, you know, people are gonna say, whatever. But if I launch a dinner party site with 10 menus, like, that's valuable, and that's interesting. So it's, you know, but the modular recipes are also designed to build on each other. You know, so hopefully once, you know, we sort of nail down all the metadata and everything for a roast chicken, you know, we never have to write that again. It can be used for the next recipe, or it can be used as a component for something else. So these first few, it's just a lot of time and effort, and then hopefully if it, you know, from there it can snowball.
And that's really where the structure of the basic techniques and basic flavor combinations really come into handy, because if you think, you know, roasting a chicken, you teach someone how to roast a chicken, and then you can swap out three or four spices or a vegetable, very simple kind of move, and you've created a whole different kind of menu. So that gets around the whole thing, well, oh, this doesn't have 100,000 recipes. Well, I would argue those websites that have 100,000 recipes, there's like 12 techniques and like, you know, 50 flavor combinations that are in there. And it's just all just, you know, variations.
So I was at a panel earlier on about designing for context. So it's kind of fascinating to hear you talk about the context of being in the kitchen and the different devices, you know, you say squinting at the iPad and stuff. But I was wondering, when you were looking at the pain points people had with trying to put together a dinner party, did you take into account the context of when people are initially shopping for the ingredients and trying to make that, you know, easier?
Yeah, I mean, the model that I kind of kept using in my thinking, I call it the eating life cycle. You know, and it's really around planning, shopping, eating, and then having fun. Right. And you know, I think when you go through that, if you have a lot of fun, then that sort of drives you back to the next thing. So, like, the shopping list that was in the app was horrendous. I mean, I need to, like, rewrite it so that it takes 100 grams of beets and turns it into, you know, two medium or one large. There's a lot of work that still needs to be done around, you know, how do you convert that from one thing to another, but I think it's definitely, you know, something that is top of mind.
Yeah, and a lot of the digital delivery services are great too, because, you know, you could theoretically plug into that and just hit the menu button, and yeah, all the stuff you need is going to be, you know, sent to you. I mean, that's one context definitely of I say I want a dinner party first, right, and then I figure out how to get the ingredients second. That's one very kind of way you cook, and that's the way we designed this prototype for. The other way is I'm hungry, I have these 9 things, you know, kind of like the secret basket. So that's another kind of mode that I think is a very different
way. And a lot of what we're just trying to do is to build this like modular engine that can work that way, you know. So, you know, theoretically, you know, you could optimize it around, you know, okay, plan my meals based on what's on sale this week at the grocery store, you know, and just have it be a one-click, you know, purchase and then go.
Have you thought about the process of documenting your dinner parties? Obviously, you took some great, or you had the Stephen Goralnik take nice photos, and it's you're able to share that with us. And I was just thinking about documenting experiences and what you did serve, who came that night, what you talked about, you know, that kind of thing.
Generally, so we've been doing these weird dinner parties for like 5 years, and you know, I always wanted to document what we were doing, but I couldn't always hire a photographer to follow me around and like watch all the prep happening. If you go to the website on studiofeast.com, I have a bunch of time lapses, and that was kind of a solution that I came across that was nice because I could just sit there and worry about what I was doing and set up the camera and have it kind of collect the footage, like, you know, in the background there. Because it definitely breaks up the flow when you have to chop an onion and then you're trying to document it like that. So you do need kind of another resource to, that shouldn't be in your cooking workflow. Yeah.
I think a lot of it, you know, some of the way we've thought about it too is how do you sort of, either with video or with photos, just create these very small discrete moments that capture like chopping an onion or plating something, because you don't want to get in a situation where you have to take a photograph of every single, you know, million variations.
I mean, video comes into play really big when you think about how to teach people techniques. I mean, I've been cooking for a really long time. Will's been cooking for a really long time, and I don't know about you, but I still get confused if I go to a recipe website and, you know, let's say I'm reading about how to truss a chicken. Like, it's really weird and unnatural to read about how to do that. They say, oh, pull the string counterclockwise, make a figure eight, perpendicular to the legs. You're like, I have no idea what that means. So the video can really solve that problem because, at least for me, I'm a very visual thinker, and just seeing it done, I can emulate it much easier. So that's another thing to think about.
And Mike's actually, last year, he did some cooking classes on Google+ using Hangouts. And so that'd be an interesting format I'd like to see explored more, where you have like 10 people sort of all on their laptops or their computers in the kitchen all doing something at the same time.
Yeah, cooking is like the ultimate show, don't tell, as that saying goes. Right. So. Anything else?
Anyone else? Oh, yeah. You have to go to the mic. It's a podcast. So otherwise, I have to repeat the question.
So do you guys have any like policies on devices at the table or during the dinner party? Like, do you, and what's your take generally on that? Like, do you feel like it enhances the experience or detracts? Or?
Yeah, yes and no. A couple month or two ago, I had tweeted around, there's this game that people play where when you go out to dinner with all your friends, everybody puts their device in the center of the table and you stack them up, and the first person to grab their device picks up the tab for everyone.
I love that game too.
It's kind of a simple way. I think it's just a balance. At some point, if someone's on their device all at dinner, then nobody's talking to them, and you end up with like these subgroups. So a lot of it, just if you have interesting conversation, it's just going to drive people less and less to want to check in.
It's definitely striking a balance. I mean, obviously, I'm not going to be hypocritical because we had these photographs, but you know, this was kind of designed in a context of like we need some photographs to document this process, but I'm concerned about the whole like sportification of food and making it, are you eating just to eat anymore or to taste great things? Or are you just eating to have a great Facebook wall? Like, I think that's an issue. So, you know, I will occasionally, you know, take a picture of something that looks really good, but, you know, I don't know, just a balance, like with anything in life.
Thanks.
Cool.
Yep.
Hey guys, I guess back to this balance component, can you guys talk about this dual life aspect? How do you guys balance it? How do you see it going forward, especially as you sort of delve deeper into your app? I'd just love to hear about it. I'm sure there's a lot of moonlighting chefs out there, and just love to hear the stories.
You want to go first?
I'll let you go first.
You know, the balance forces you to be more efficient and more together than you normally would be. Nothing on paper says I should be able to do these dinners. People are like, why do you do these ridiculous dinners? Why does this suck up all of your free time? I akin it to just a really nasty habit of golf, but it breaks even, you know? Like, if you think about people that have hobbies like this, they devote just as much time. Mine, I don't know, it forces me definitely to be just more organized, yeah, because the little bit of time I do have, I have to have everything together and ready to go.
Yeah. For me, it's just a big passion point. I mean, I love to cook, but naturally, you know, I'm a very technology-oriented thinker and person, so for me, it's a fun challenge to how do you synthesize those two. I mean, cooking is a very analog thing, but you'd be amazed at how much, you know, digital and technology can actually improve that.
Hey guys, it was a really kind of interesting thought starter seeing the earlier the robots kind of serving food, yep, and any number of kind of things where, you know, robots were doing certain parts of the experience. And I guess my question is, and just kind of my own curiosity of, through working through these kinds of projects, have you come to think about, or you have like a certain kind of position on what parts of the experiences have to be a human, and what parts can be technology and that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think a lot of it just has to do with scale. I mean, you know, Mike and I both have cooked in a lot of different kitchens, you know, and even just when you go over to your friend's house and you're helping out, you know, things are in different drawers, they're in different places, they have an electric stove, you have a gas stove, you know. The variables and the way people have things laid out is very different. And so just looking at the robots as an example, you know, a lot of their focus is around learning, you know, because that's what we do when we get anywhere is, okay, wait, how do you have it laid out? And I think the fact that every kitchen is kind of different in its own way is actually what's holding back a lot of this automation. I mean, a lot of those robots, you know, when I was reading some interviews with some of the people working on it, and they basically were like, well, how would this work in someone's home, or what about this? And they're like, yeah, this is really for factory work, you know, or this is designed for, like, you know, if you're, you know, work at like a nursing home or a hospital and you need to have a way to like automate production of 1,000 of the exact same things. I mean, that's really where a lot of their space is, because the home problem is too hard to get right at first. So they're going to start there, and then maybe over time, as the robots learn quicker and faster and better, then it might be applicable to the home cook.
So. Yeah, I mean, this is pretty obvious, but I think, you know, I'm all for technology helping you out in the kitchen, and, you know, to the extent that we can get better versions of the Slap Chop out there helping people, that's great. But I think the one thing is just the taste can never be reproduced. Like, a chef has to just be able to judge things on the fly, and, you know, recipes don't always work out that way. So I think having that intelligence of the chef to just taste and just adjust on the fly is something you can't, I don't know if we'll be able to digitize that, so.
Cool.
Hi.
Hi.
So just talking about what you guys were talking about, being able to do it on the fly, mm-hmm. Like, for me, when I'm planning a dinner party, for me, it's like the last 20 minutes or the go time, and getting everything hot and on the table at the same, yeah, time is the hardest part. So part of your app, I didn't know that you didn't mention it, or maybe it's you're already planning on it. Are you going to have, like, a notes feature so people can, you know, kind of adjust the dinner party or the menu or the recipes for what worked for them? I mean, it's an idea, and also maybe a way to share that with others.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the core of this is kind of figuring out what's your personality and profile. I mean, like, we focused for this instance on the dietary restrictions, you know, but what I'd really love to do is to extend that to just things you don't like or things you love, you know. So it's like, you know what, I'm not crazy about beets, but I love anything with melted cheese on it. You know, and that's what gets people excited, you know, is like, oh, hey, this, it's my favorite foods. So I think a lot of it is, and that goes to the cooking process as well. You know, I think everyone has their, you know, my wife is one of these people who loves to make everything in advance. And she'll make it in advance and then prepare and then do that. And I'm more of a, you know, let's just, yeah, come home and whip something up at the last minute. So I think a lot of it is, how do we, you know, develop, you know, to me, this is an interesting first step into, right, starting to develop that profile and have a tool that if people are interacting with it, then, you know, we can use that over time to sort of make it more tailored to you.
Right.
And I think the other key choice that you have to make in cooking is deciding, do you want something to arrive, all the food to arrive at the table at the same time and eat family style, yeah. or do you want to do paced out, like plated yeah. courses and things like that?
Like our dinner party, we actually made that call at the last minute. We were thinking of it as like, you know, five courses and all sort of like very fine dining. And
yeah.
things were running over, so we said, screw it, family yeah, so style.
Your timeline goes. Your timeline of work goes beyond the point of where you've started eating, right? Because it's like, okay, then one of the, you know, eat the appetizer, get up, you know, wash right. clear the dishes and do this and this. So that's another thing to think about.
Yeah, you don't want the person to start feeling like a robot, right?
Right.
Like this
yeah,
there.
Exactly.
And then I was just going to say, good work, and it's really impressive, and you've got a lot of work cut out for you. I mean, if you're creating all these different tools that are going to talk to each other, like the shopping list, converting grams to what you were saying, and are you, you said you're creating all the recipes yourself?
So, I mean, in this instance, you know, Mike sort of created the recipes and I sort of built the app, but I mean, like if I, in my mind of what I'd like to build, I think we're probably about 1% of the way there.
Right. Yeah.
So it's definitely, it's about the journey.
Okay. Yeah. Good luck.
Thank you.
Anything else? Well, thanks, guys. Say hi to us on Twitter. Give us any feedback.